Dr. Stephen Dorrell, I am now retired, been retired for a number of years from the University of Huddersfield. Author, investigative journalist, academic. My specialization has been British intelligence, mostly MI6, and I wrote a post-war history of MI6 special operations, but I'm also author of a biography of Sir Oswald Mosley and British fascism.
Fascinating. Well, look, be great to get your take on what's been going on the last week or so in Britain since this murder of these three little school kids. And also, of course, we're dealing with Parliament in recess. So there's very little discussion and debate by MPs, but obviously a lot of influence and pronouncements by government. So could you just give us your, I know you've written a letter to The Guardian, and whether or not they publish it, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, I can read it to you if you like. 43 years ago this month, Michael Heseltine issued his minute. It took a riot. It seemed no one will issue a similar one now. Civil disorder is the language used by the inarticulate and those who say they have no voice. This is about racism, but it's also about so much more. Journalist reports during the general election campaign portrayed a divided country with serious poverty and a lack of hope set against the backdrop of the failure of Brexit. A brilliant but ignored paper, The Gender Backlash in the Vote for Brexit by Jane Green and Rosalind Shorrocks, 2021, identified, quote, gender-based resentment by men as a significant factor. It represented a rejection of social, economic, and cultural change. It was not just about policy direction, but about the direction of society as a whole. The UK, 21st in the world in terms of GDP per capita, with continually falling household incomes, is a low-wage, low-skilled economy which simply does not work. Until that is addressed, quote, anger and resentment, unquote, will continue to grow. And I think that's what's happening. I think the kind of knee-jerk reaction from the Labour government is no different from the Conservatives in 1981 or in other periods.
Could you just tell us a bit more about what Heseltine was up to that you were referring to there, and what
Well,
the
this was at the
background
time of
was?
the 1981 riots around the country, and I'd have to say they were riots. I'm not sure that you can actually class what's happening today as riots. It's certainly civil disorder, but there are some rather odd things about it, like, families turning up. It's almost like some kind of spectator sport that you stand around and see what's happening, and you see police basically doing nothing. But in real riots, which is what happened in the early 1980s, places were set afire. There was real violence between demonstrators and the police, and it was serious. Now, there's obviously serious aspects to this, but it is all a rather strange event, I think. And then you get, as I said, this knee-jerk reaction from the government, and you get the attack on civil liberties. It's only a week ago that Labour MPs were asking the Home Secretary and Prime Minister Starmer to stop the use of facial recognition, but now he wants to go much further. But in the 1980s, we had this kind of reaction, and Heseltine was very good. He went and visited the places, and he wrote a memo which went to the cabinet and said, "Look, we have to do something because this is serious. There's serious problems in some of the northern cities and areas. There is a racial problem, discrimination, the black community, and it needs investment." And that's where it said it took a riot to actually get people to take it seriously and put the investment in. And I think, there's a historical thing. How do we progress? And there's one view of history, which is it's incremental. We do a gradual kind of progress, but I don't think that's working. Or, in fact, it does take a riot for people to actually sit up and take notice and do something.
It sounds to me like you are inciting a riot there, Stephen, as a
Well, no, it's just,
intellectual.
unfortunately, this is so predictable. It shouldn't have taken place. It shouldn't have happened. Violence is wrong. But unfortunately, the system that we operate in, which is, to my mind, not very democratic. You get a government elected with a massive majority on a very small vote, one of the lowest votes in electoral history. And they do nothing, and they come in and they say, basically, we're not going to spend any money. We're not going to alleviate some of the major social and economic problems. So I think, unfortunately, these things are inevitable.
Yeah, so you've got this background of low per capita GDP and sinking fast. But then there's also this thing they sort of term the cost of living crisis, which is all those bits of infrastructure that Margaret Thatcher privatised in the 80s, things like the water, the gas, electricity, council housing, these sorts of things, the rents, the fuel bills, the water bills, they're all going through the roof at the same time. So there seems to be something structural. Now, what bothers me is this almost fuels resentment. And so if there's any excuse, people will sort of come out on the streets and vent their anger.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the fundamentals are wrong. It's very difficult for ordinary working class families, or even moving into middle class now, to have a reasonable life. People are scratching around all the time to pay the bills. The housing is simply too expensive. The rents are too high. Food is going up. And I think essentially this is a Brexit problem. It destroyed the Conservative Party. And now I think this civil disobedience disorder is a result of Brexit. Because Brexit allowed certain things to be said. And we know that behind a lot of the Leave vote was a deep resentment and a racism, etc. But it was also even deeper than that, as you said, about some of the economic and social problems going on. But they're not being addressed. And, when you have a group of young men who have this kind of background, it is inevitable that something like this will happen. We've seen it so many times in history, and it's simple things like the weather's good. There's no football on, and there's no youth clubs. And you have kids, young people hanging around, and they're looking for excitement and they're finding it. And then I think the way that this has been dealt with by the media is very poor. This total focus really on social media, I think, is wrong. Now, there's huge problems with social media, and I rarely use it because I know, as a former lecturer on the media and journalism, the problems of it. But in the past, it didn't take social media to get the far right or the extreme right or the fascists or whatever onto the streets. They came on anyway. And I think it's an excuse to blame it on social media. One of the differences, I think, this time is, in some ways, this is just totally unorganized. It appears in various places. They're not really large groups. They're not the kind of size of groups that rioted in the early 80s, or when I recall in the mid-70s when there was a battle with the National Front. And the police are basically standing around, allowing things to happen, because I assume they simply do not have the numbers of officers to control these kind of events. I mean, I run a film festival in Holme Firth, West Yorkshire, and we just put on Strike, the film about the miners' strike, and Orgreave. And you had thousands of police there, organized, ready, and taking on the miners with really vicious violence. This is very different. It's almost in some ways like play. Now, again, there are very serious aspects to this, but I think the media is just overplaying this. And because they've done that, they are inciting more violence and more demonstrations, because the far right now knows that there is a limited police presence, and you can pop up anywhere. I don't think it's that well organized. It's just, you know, a few phone calls and all the rest of it. I'll get a few dozen people on the street and something happens and it takes off.
There is a lot of evidence of links to Israel and Tommy Robinson. He's turned up with when the EDL was in full flow at several of these pro-Israeli rallies in London with the Israeli flag flying. And there is evidence, you know, linking the two. Do you think that there's any possibility that this is part of the kind of home front struggle? There's been a complete failure, really, of the pro-Zionist lobby in London to get counter-demonstrations out in any numbers on the streets against the every other Saturday. Now we've got 100,000 and 150,000 people peacefully marching for Palestine. This maybe is just an attempt to try and take that pro-Israel, the failed so far pro-Israel movement on, because Tommy does have sympathies and links to the Israel lobby.
And he does, and he's quite clever, isn't he? He got out of the country before this started, so he can do this. That's one thing about social media. You don't actually have to be in the country anymore to organize or take part in these kind of things. But I think perhaps we give him and the movement too much intelligence. I don't think it's that well coordinated. I think, you know, people can see things on YouTube or on TV and it looks interesting and different and something's happening and they go and join. In some ways, it's good that there hasn't been a counter to this, because, you know, tonight there's this video of Asian youth in Birmingham, which looks very threatening. And it's been good so far because there hasn't been a real counter to this, what's been dubbed far right, which will inflame it even more. That's the great danger. And I think that's the danger that the police think is going to happen. I think that's why they've held back, really. But I just think there are a number of things. Again, Brexit, Gaza, all these kind of things, that immigration, of course, and all that. It's a melange. I don't think there's any real ideology here at all. It's not as Mosley in the 30s, which
certainly not the scale. You've looked into MI6 a lot. You've done quite a lot of work on foreign intelligence and the Foreign Office, and they're the sort of dirty tricks department, I suppose you'd call them. But they seem very pro-Israel as well, and yet this is out of step with the nation as a whole. We've just had a supposed change of government, but the policy hasn't apparently shifted at all, supporting the Israelis whilst this genocide is going on. I just wonder if you've got any insight, Stephen, into what's in it for us. Why are we supporting the Israelis at the moment?
Oh, it's the Americans. It's totally the Americans. No, the relationship between MI6 and Israel and Israeli intelligence is complex, because it obviously, if you go back to the 1940s and creation of the State of Israel, MI6 and Israelis were against each other. But by the late 50s, they were helping each other in the Middle East, though there was no official cooperation. And that developed sometime later. But really, this is about the Americans. When Labour politicians were saying, in opposition, there's nothing we can do, I was saying, I did write that, in fact, there are things that can be done. And I pointed out that Cyprus is a major listening base for GCHQ, the British listening posts, which works hand in glove with the National Security Agency in America, monitors the Middle East, and supplies intelligence to the Israelis.
Well, funnily enough, this is where Tommy Robinson's gone, Cyprus. Anyway, that may be a red herring. Sorry to throw that in.
Yeah, it's a red herring, I think, but it's important. And there is cooperation, particularly on counterterrorism and those kind of areas. But the intelligence links have been completely underplayed by the previous Conservative government and now by the Labour government. So if you wanted to do something, you would cut that link. There is a direct thing you can do, which is you would ask the CIA officer who comes into the Joint Intelligence Committee meetings, which discusses Israel, to leave. But then you would have a serious situation where the Americans would put on a huge amount of pressure. Now, I would ignore it, but I can see with the problem in that it's estimated that 80% of intelligence that MI6 and British intelligence use is actually derived from the Americans, because they have huge organizations, a lot of money, and their reach across the globe intelligence-wise is massive compared to MI6, which is relatively small. So they do not want to jeopardize that. And that's what's really behind this. Any move to cut links with Israel, the Americans would jump on it, and they will threaten the intelligence link, and they will threaten to cut links economically, defense-wise. So you've got to be a tough prime minister to stand up to that. Strangely enough, the only one that has was Edward Heath in 1973, when he banned the Americans from, again, using Cyprus for arms transfers and flying across the UK. And they then threatened to cut the intelligence link. But I see no evidence.
Harold Wilson did as well, didn't he? He wouldn't go into Vietnam. The Americans were saying, come on, you've got to come running to Vietnam and help us. But look, back up to today, because there are some underlying problems, aren't there, that are fueling this, namely mass immigration, which has been, I think you probably agree, fueled by the economic disaster here. As there's success in Russia and China and the BRICS countries, the West seems to be literally going down the pan economically. And so they've brought in all these new visas, which, for example, for care workers, long-term visas where people can come and work in care homes because the wages are too low for British people to be able to work there and pay the bills. And, you know, there's an implication that these jobs people just don't want to do. Well, they will do them if they get in, if they're paid enough, but they're not. And so this migration is seen by many people as undermining the pay and conditions the British unions and workers have been trying to maintain for decades, maybe even, you know, 200 years.
There's an element of truth to that. I think it's more complicated than that. And again, I think it's partly to do with Brexit, in that free movement in the EU worked. And we can see a great change in 2016 with Brexit, where that free movement stopped, and so you have immigration. Now, the argument is that immigration or immigrants bring in money and they work and they pay taxes. That's absolutely true. However, recent research has said this is essentially a Ponzi scheme, in that they are paying taxes. And they are paying for the pensions of people like me and others. But their money is going to pay people now. There will not be enough, and this is in a recent UN report, to pay for pensions for them in 30, 40, 50 years' time. And the only way that you can pay for those pensions and you know, lots of other social things and lots of expenditure by the state, etc., is by bringing in more immigration. And so you end up with this endless cycle, and it's hard to get out of, because it does bring with it this low wage, low skilled economy.
Well, you know what else it brings is, and that is it props up house prices, doesn't it, which also helps GDP. So it seems as if everything is being done to the bottom GDP, to prop up the GDP bottom line, but bit by bit, the entire economy is being undermined. Well, I mean, just to finish, do you think there are any solutions to the underlying social problems? You know, any economic solutions can you suggest? And it's nice to, rather than just sort of wave our fist at
Yes.
these idiots at the Bank of England and the Treasury, it's nice to have some sort of, at least some suggestions of the turns that they should make to improve things.
Well, if you look at pay scales, wage scales, the average incomes of the British are very low. And I don't think most people realize how low they are compared to, say, France or Germany, or my brother works in Australia, and theirs is much higher. You've got to raise wages, the minimum income, and those kind of areas. But essentially, I think you have no choice, and it will happen. You've got to go back into the European Union. If you are losing 4 or 5% each year of GDP, which we are, and that accumulates, then there is really no way out of this, because the governments at the moment are not willing to invest the huge sums required, as Biden has done in the United States, to get the economy moving and to get the cost of living down. So it's, you know, there are solutions, and the housing problem is lack of social housing. But the solution by the Labour Party, the Labour government, won't solve that. You know, the government own figures show that if you build 300,000 houses a year, it will only reduce the prices of houses by 6%, and then they will soon start going back up again. So you've got to do things about land, the cost of land. That's the most important part. And you've got to control rents. And if you control rents, you control house prices, because house prices are based on rental value. And it can be done in Vienna and places. They have much lower rents. But we've become a rentier country again, where no longer are local authorities building social homes at reasonable rents. It's private rentiers putting up rents as much as they can. So there are things you can do. Whether this government is willing to do that is another matter.
Stephen, are there places people, I don't know if you've got a blog or whether you do any, you say you don't really do much social media, whether you tweet or if there's anywhere people can follow you?
I don't. You'll find some films on YouTube, and I continue to write books and write articles and all those kind of things. And there will be a couple of books coming out next year. So I'm still active, and I put in a lot of research with other projects and people. So,
well, glad to hear you're still scribbling away. Can you just remind us of your MI6 book titles? I'm sure some listeners will be interested in that, and some of your more recent books.
Okay, well, the MI6 one is very simple. MI6, 50 years of special operations, and the biography of Sir Oswald Mosley was Blackshirt, Sir Oswald Mosley and British Fascism. And I did a big piece, about 4 years ago, on the relationship between MI6 and journalists, which is an ongoing project.
Look, you can't say that as a final thing without me pressing you a bit on it, because we keep hearing about the love that the intelligence services have for being able to get their articles into newspapers. In fact, one does wonder sometimes whether ordinary freelancers, people like myself and yourself, are squeezed out. There's so much pressure and so much lobbying by the intelligence services to get their people in the foreign pages.
Historically, this isn't social media is, I mean, it's a known goal. It's easy. Anybody can put stuff on social media. And as you mentioned, the Russians are doing that all the time, and they're involved currently in what's going on. But it's historically, the key periods really were in the from the 50s to the 70s, when, you know, I'd say 50% of foreign correspondents were actually working in some way for MI6, British correspondents, that they were either directly funded, directly run, or what is known as unconscious agents, which is that they are helped. And sometimes they don't know where that help came from, but they did get help. It may be easing their promotion, maybe easing access to countries and all those kind of things. And then they come back and say, well, we helped you do that. You can help us now. But fortunately, there is much more cynicism about all of that. And many foreign correspondents nowadays are very wary of getting in bed with the intelligence services. But as I said, social media is just so easy to do for disinformation and for putting out whatever view that the intelligence services want to do. We see it all the time, and you spend a lot of time kind of dismantling these pieces and seeing what's really going on.
Yeah, it's a bit bizarre, isn't it? But okay, Stephen, well, your books that you're working on at the moment, can I be a bit cheeky?
I'm working on there's a book on Northern Ireland and intelligence in Northern Ireland and certain operations, and quite a lot to do with the media, based on a lot of documents that have not been seen before. So that should be interesting. And a one on it's titled Are the Russians Coming? It's about the thought that the Russians might invade Europe after the Second World War.
Right, yeah. No, because I can remember reading, is this Operation Unthinkable, when Winston Churchill was seriously considering nuking Russia. In fact, I spoke to colleagues that told me that he had to be kept off the BBC. They could put him on the TV and the radio, but never live in the 1940s and 50s, because he was obsessed, and they didn't want him to talk about nuking Russia live. So they knew if it was pre-recorded or then they could always edit that bit out with Winston Churchill.
I think if he'd had his way, June of 1945, the British and American armies would have carried on through Berlin. But fortunately, there were some level heads in the military who thought it was a stupid idea. And so it stopped. But there were these ideas, and there were, ideas of, and they came from the British, not the Americans, of nuking key places in Europe and the Middle East to stop them being used by the Russians.
Fascinating. Can't wait for that one. All right, Stephen Dorrell, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.